so-called that trap is got to do with China's Belt and Road Initiative. So goes the rhetoric that the China's Belt and Road Initiative is entrapping the recipient countries, but the reality is nothing of the sort, according to recent research conducted by a UK-based charity called Debt Justice. According to the latest research, in fact, the recipient countries are more indebted to Western commercial lenders multiple times compared with the debt incurred under China's Belt and Road Initiative. But coming back to Sri Lanka, which of course is the poster child of the so-called debt trap diplomacy, because the indebtedness of Sri Lanka to China has resulted in giving the port, the Hambantota port, to China under almost 100-year lease in payment of the debt. But the reality remains that even before the Hambantota port project, Sri Lanka was already heavily in debt to, as I said, Western commercial lenders. Now, coming back to the rivalry between India and China, of course, this is across the board on all fronts. For a decade, India has been losing ground to China as far as Sri Lanka is concerned. But now it's now making up for lost grounds, extending a lot of loans, much needed loans to Sri Lanka, including some projects on fisheries and ports, and also giving a credit, something like $4 billion credit to Sri Lanka. So all this has been much well received in comparison with only about 60 or 70 million dollars debt, additional debt given by China. But under India's new neighborhood first policy, it's trying to build up stronger relations with its neighboring countries, including Sri Lanka, which of course was under Indians' influence a decade ago, before China came in. But China's strength, of course, is not just in the these projects, which of course part of the Belt and Road Initiative, as I said. The Belt and Road Initiative is linked to the world's largest trading bloc, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, consisting of the ASEAN countries, together with the major trading partners in the region. This RCEP, Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, is the world's largest trading bloc, accounting for one-third of the world's economy and one-third of the world's population. But unfortunately, India is not has chosen not to be part of it. And China is right at the heart of this regional regional comprehensive economic partnership trading bloc. In the sense that China is the center of the regional supply and value chain. China, of course, is the largest trading partner, not only in the region, but in the world. It's the largest manufacturer. It's a huge internal market. So China's got all these strengths. And the jury is still out on whether India or China in Sri Lanka.
So, Mr. Leung, both India and China have their own interests in the South Asian island country. So how much is this debt trap diplomacy going to affect the sovereignty of Sri Lanka?
Sri Lanka still remains very jealous of its own sovereignty. And it's, even with all these loans from India, Sri Lanka remains relatively a little bit suspicious of the reversion of the occurrence of India's hegemony over India, over Sri Lanka. But I think that In recent years, all ASEAN countries, in fact, all most of the developing world, are very conscious of their own sovereignty. No country wants to be under another country's thumb. But nevertheless, the reality remains that all countries depend on their economy, and the economy depends on the world trade and also foreign investments. And China, of course, is the largest trader. And it's also the largest foreign source of foreign investment. And as I said, with the Belt and Road linking the whole world together to the global and supply to its global supply and value chain, as the world's largest trader and manufacturer and the world's largest consumer market, so China has got all the advantages.
Last but not least, sir, following New Delhi, Beijing has given financing assurance to Sri Lanka for the IMF bailout package. So do you think Sri Lanka will come out of this economic crisis anytime soon?
Well, the India's lending to Sri Lanka recently is also depending on the IMF bailout. But experienced by many developing countries around the world, the IMF bailout comes with a lot of conditions imposed on their own governance, the system, make the system much more open to outside influence or outside investments than some countries are prepared to concede. So it remains to be seen whether Sri Lanka would embrace all the conditions in order to accept this bailout. And then the willingness of Sri Lanka's acceptance of the IMF conditions would also affect its future, the ease with which Indians attempt to recover its influence in Sri Lanka. So it all depends on what the IMF bailout would be, what the conditions are, and to what extent the Sri Lankan government is prepared to accept those conditions.
There you have it, Mr. Andrew K.P. Leung, an international and independent China strategist from Hong Kong. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Wang Xiaoyan, the spokesperson of the Chinese embassy in India, writes, China stands ready to work with relevant countries and international financial institutions and continue to play a positive role in helping Sri Lanka navigate the situation, easing its debt burden and helping it achieve sustainable development. One of the Indian news channels tweeted, on close ties with China, Foreign Minister Ali Sabri said Sri Lanka has never undermined India's interests and will not allow anyone else to threaten India's security concerns. Dr. R. De Silva says, another Western competing view of foreign interference in Sri Lanka and on the behavior and motives of the IMF. Views we must consider include the West, Africa, China, Russia, and India. Imperative is, however, the effects on the well-being of Sri Lankans. Sidhant Sibal, a journalist, said, days after India announced its support for Sri Lanka's debt restructuring, China rushed to extend support. Sri Lankan media reports says government in Colombo rather disappointed with Chinese letter and Beijing's response fell short of what was expected.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
The Pakistani government and the Russian energy minister Nikolai Shulginov, who was in Islamabad just recently for an annual intergovernmental commission on trade and economy, said the key elements of the energy deal between the two countries will be finalized by March this year. Pakistan and Russia have also agreed to strengthen their ties in the areas of energy cooperation, enhancing energy trade, and also to broaden energy infrastructure investment. According to the two sides, comprehensive gas infrastructure plan for energy cooperation is going to be the stepping stone for future deals between Moscow and Islamabad, with other things remaining the same.
Pakistan is going to be Russia's new energy partner. The two sides have agreed to pay for the energy purchases in the currencies of the friendly countries. The announcement was made at the conclusion of the eighth session of the Pakistan-Russia Intergovernmental Commission, IGC, on Trade, Economic, Scientific and Technical Cooperation, which took place last week in Islamabad. The friendly country is likely to be China, which shares good relations with both Russia and Pakistan. This move is expected to affect the monopoly of the dollar as being the reserve currency of the world. Countries like China, Iran, Russia, and Venezuela have already done trade deals in local currencies, thus challenging the hegemony of the U.S. dollar.
De-dollarization is certainly the way to go. I don't know exactly how Russia and Pakistan plan to proceed payments, but I'm sure a way will be found. And let me remind you that just last year, Iran has signed a deal with China. Iran will supply huge amounts of oil to China, worth probably of billions of dollars, $300 billion. This amount was mentioned. Obviously, Pakistan and China found a way to make payments for this oil. And obviously, these payments are not going to be made in dollars because Iran has been switched off from the SWIFT system under pressure from the United States. So we know the story. Obviously, if Iran found a way to trade oil with China and to get payment for it without dollars, then probably the same solution can be found between Russia and Pakistan, even though it was not immediately clear how this deal will be proceeded with financially.
Pakistan officials had visited Moscow last year to explore the possibility of the import of crude oil from Russia on discounted rates. After a series of talks, the two countries agreed that the import of crude oil to the cash-stripped South Asian country will take place from March this year. Both Moscow and Islamabad acknowledged the importance of this growing relationship for the economic progress of both the countries and also of the region.
That Russia is going to conclude with Pakistan. If everything works out, then according to the information of the Russian energy minister, Mr. Shulginov, Russia will be able to supply 35% of Pakistan's needs in crude oil. This is a lot. And of course, Iran could also participate in this process of providing oil and energy to Pakistani industry. I don't know in what state the pipeline is, which should connect Iran and Pakistan. This is for the Iranian side, maybe, to clarify. But Russia would have nothing against joint efforts of Russia and Iran in supplying for the needs of developing countries. Pakistan is a country that we have a friendly relationship now with. There was a period in the Soviet times when Pakistan became a sort of an agent of the United States. It was under the dictatorial regime of ضیاء-الحق. But that was long ago. Times have changed. Now we know very well that Pakistani people have a positive view of Russia. They view Russia as an ally. They're very much angry with the United States after the drone war and other cruelties that Americans have committed against Pakistanis.
Pakistan's foreign exchange reserves have depleted to about $4.6 billion, barely enough to cover a month's oil imports. In this situation, Islamabad has decided to buy oil at discounted rates from Moscow to protect its deteriorating financial situation. To defend this move, the country has cited India's example, which has been buying oil from Russia for a long time now. This deal appears to be a win-win situation for both the countries, as Pakistan would want to be a part of the regional bloc that has Moscow and Beijing as its important members, and in turn, Russia's close ties with Islamabad will have an impact on the security and strategic stability in the region.
Historically, Pakistan did not share close commercial ties with Russia. Islamabad has been dependent for oil on the Persian Gulf countries, especially Saudi Arabia and the UAE. However, this trend seems to be changing with Pakistan's announcement that the country is intending to fulfill 35% of its crude oil imports through Russia. Getting Russian oil will reduce the market share of the Arab countries and may also have an impact on the diplomatic and trade relations Islamabad shares with these countries.
Well, Persian Gulf countries understand that this is the market. Everyone is looking for customers. Everyone is looking for markets. Russia did not protest when Germany decided to replace Russian gas on its market by gas from Qatar. We have nothing against it. This is market. However, I would say that it was very stupid of Germany to insult Qataris during the soccer, during the football World Cup in Qatar, by constantly mentioning the theme of homosexuals living in Qatar. Germany should be busy with its own affairs. It should not insult other countries, especially those who invited with its shitty team to the international sports events. So I think sooner or later, European countries will become unwanted clients for Persian Gulf states, simply because Europeans are getting so rude and unbearable in, even in diplomatic ties.
It is important to mention that this development comes at a time when the G7 countries are scheduled to meet in March to review the price cap on exports of Russian oil. The growing bonhomie between Russia and Pakistan can be a cause of concern for the West, also because of Islamabad's strategic location in the region. Having signed agreements for cooperation in the customs and aviation sector as well, thus improving relations between the two countries, is worrying for the U.S. and its allies, as it will probably allow Russia to challenge the presence of NATO in one of the world's most strategic zones.
Well, I don't think we need military aid from Pakistan, because Russia can defend itself on its own. We don't need, any weapons from Muslim countries which suffered from Western aggressions. And to my mind, what happened in Pakistan between 2001, when the United States occupied Afghanistan, and 2021, I think it was terrible. It was, Pakistan suffered almost as severely as Afghanistan during the bombings, during the drone attacks. So this is all over, thank God. Now, if Pakistan understands our fight, why we're defending ourselves from NATO, fine. We'll be happy to get diplomatic support. We'll be happy if Pakistan supports us politically. But I have not heard about any weapons supplies or any kind of military aid that we would require from Pakistan.
Now let's see what people had to say on the latest deal between Russia and Pakistan for the import of crude oil to the energy-starved country.
Tweeting about the currency, Centelets wrote, "Russia and Pakistan conclude an oil deal that will be settled in national currencies. Soon, no one will want to transact in U.S. dollars." Abdul Rahman, an investor, said, "Russia hints at Pakistan-Russia crude oil deal tentatively from March 2023. Most probably, Chinese yuan will be used for payment. Two important details still awaited. Pricing, discount, volume, 50 to 100,000 barrels per day would be great for Pakistan." Edek tweeted, "Russia and Pakistan agree major energy deal. Oil and gas exports from the sanctions-hit country will help the world's fifth most populous nation meet its demands."
And that was our episode about the Russia-Pakistan changing relation dynamics and its impact on world politics. And also, Sri Lanka's economic crisis with India and China competing to gain foothold in the island country. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Iran's domestic production capacities. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. As you know, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, dubs every Iranian calendar year with a theme which fits to the conditions of the time. The leader named this year as the year of production, knowledge base, job creating. The themes of the year are chosen by Ayatollah Khamenei to motivate the officials and the people towards putting the internal potential capacities into effect to push the country on the course of progress. Thus, we have prepared a series to briefly review Iran's capacities in various fields. In the sixth episode of this series, you will get familiar with Iran's progresses in the medical and hygiene field. Stay tuned, please. Medical equipment industry has developed with the growth of human communities. The value of medical equipment market is more than $500 billion, and it is estimated that this section will continue growing due to the increase of senile population and spread of some diseases. Presently, the U.S. enjoys 39% of the share of this market, and Germany, Japan, and China stand in the next positions. The Islamic Republic of Iran has greatly invested in the medical equipment section. The rate of medical equipment growth is 9.1% in Iran, which is higher than the global average. Iran's medical equipment market enjoys a capacity of $7 billion. $2 billion of this figure is secured via imports, and $5 billion is produced by domestic companies. The Islamic Republic exported $24 million of medical equipment in 2017 to some 55 countries. The government has increased the budget of hygiene section every year. Moreover, health tourism is also on the rise in Iran, and many people come to Iran for treatment of various diseases. The Islamic Republic has the fifth greatest medical equipment market in the region. However, the U.S. oppressive sanctions have affected this section. The bulk of Iran's medical needs should be secured through exports, but medical equipment and devices are in the list of the U.S. sanctions, and Iran has to get the license of the U.S. Treasury Department to export these items. The pharmaceutical industry is the third profitable industry in the world after IT and oil and gas and petrochemicals. The revenues of pharmaceutical industry were over $1.25 trillion in 2019, and it is estimated that this number will grow to $1.59 trillion till the end of 2024. The United States gained more than $490 billion in this section in 2019, while the EU stood in the second place with nearly $195 billion. Foundation of pharmaceutical factories began in 1958 in Iran. Despite the efforts of domestic companies to compete with multinational corporations, the Iranian market was practically in the control of foreign firms. According to the studies of the Ministry of Health, Iran's maximal share of domestic production was 25%. More regrettably, most of these domestic medicines were produced with the credit of foreign corporations. The victory of the Islamic Revolution revived the hope in nationalization of pharmaceutical industry, and important steps have been taken in this field. Accordingly, many medicines have been produced with minimal prices and high quality. The completion of national pharmaceutical and medical equipment companies can be considered among important measures which have been taken to meet domestic needs. Today, more than 95% of the internal demand is fulfilled inside the country. Many basic and strategic medicines are made in Iran. Even most of the basic and packaging materials are provided internally. The pharmaceutical industry is among the sections which have lived in the tough circumstances of sanctions which have been illegally imposed by the U.S. Iran is now among the seven nations in this section, and it has enjoyed a spectacular growth in the field of pharmaceutical and medical progress, thanks to the endeavors of knowledge-based companies and young scientists and researchers. In addition to the medical section, hygiene has also paid special attention to in the world and Iran. Detergents industry, for instance, can be mentioned in this regard. Detergents are considered quick consumption products. Quick consumption products are the goods which are sold fast. Beverages, detergents, energizers, and some medicines which are sold without prescription are among quick consumption products. Approximately 80% of the world people use liquid and powder detergents for washing and bathroom. A gargantuan volume of detergents is poured into the global markets to meet the ever-increasing need of the world people. The change of lifestyle has been greatly effective in this respect. This market had a size of $117 billion in 2019, and it is estimated to have a 70% growth and reach $180 billion in 2026. The US and China are the first two producers and exporters of detergents in the world. Detergents production has a record of 70 years in Iran, and currently there are 220 active companies in this section in the country. These companies have the capacity of producing 4 million tons, but only 1.5 million tons can be produced due to the oppressive US sanctions. More than 98% of domestic need is met inside the country. Furthermore, Iran exports nearly $400 million annually, while it is estimated that the country can have the capacity of exporting $1.5 billion in near future.
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The situation in Israeli-occupied East Al-Quds remains volatile after a number of shooting operations there took the lives of at least 9 people and wounded several others. In the latest incident, 2 Israelis were wounded in an operation in the Silwan neighborhood of Al-Quds on Saturday morning. The Israeli Emergency Medical Services said one of those injured was in critical condition. The shooter, identified as a 13-year-old Palestinian, was wounded. The incident was the second Palestinian operation in Al-Quds in less than a day. On Friday, at least 7 people were killed and several others wounded in a shooting operation outside a synagogue in the Israeli-occupied East Al-Quds. Resistance movements hailed the operation. The Al-Quds Brigades, which is the military wing of the Islamic Jihad movement, praised the attack as a courageous operation. It said the attack was a natural response to the Israeli occupation and the regime's crimes against Palestinians. The Al-Quds Brigades said the operation is a testament to unity among resistance groups. Hamas also lauded the operation. The movement said the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will pay the price for any new mistake that Tel Aviv could make. Lebanon's Hezbollah and Yemen's Ansarullah movement also separately praised the action. The Friday incident followed a Thursday Israeli raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank, where at least 10 Palestinians were killed in cold blood by Israeli troops. Thursday marked the deadliest day for the Palestinians since the start of the new year. Israeli troops barred medical teams from reaching the area. Regime forces also stormed a hospital in Jenin and intentionally fired tear gas towards its pediatrics department. Separately, Israeli forces demolished a sports club in the refugee camp. All what is going on in the occupied territories is happening in the silence of the international community. The mainstream media closed its eyes to the deadliest Israeli raid on the Palestinian community in the occupied land this year, and instead, they took the side of the Israelis in the recent tensions. From the United States to Germany, to France and Ukraine, almost everyone expressed concern about the lives of Israelis during the recent violence. The storming of the Jenin refugee camp is indicative of the regime's aggressive nature in dealing with Palestinians, especially since the emergence of extremist ideologies in the Israeli cabinet. Many argue that the current Israeli cabinet is the most extremist ever since its installation in the occupied land. What highlights this extremism is the recent storming of the Al-Aqsa Mosque by Israeli far-right minister Itamar Ben-Gvir. Many brand the minister's move as the root cause of all the recent tensions between Israelis and the Palestinians in the occupied territories. The latest flare-up of Israeli violence in the occupied West Bank brings to the question the regime's motive behind such escalations. One presumption is that the regime is only after taking out the total Palestinian identity from their land. In order to do that, what could be better than suppressing them by imposing an all-out blockade on millions of Palestinians and blocking their access to the outer world? To support that presumption, it is enough to say that the Israeli cabinet is planning to deport Palestinian families, at least those who the regime deems as terrorists, from their own land. That's why it pushes ahead with its policy of demolishing Palestinian homes. Many are convinced that this amounts to utter collective punishment and ethnic cleansing. There is no doubt that what the Israeli regime is doing now in the occupied land, in terms of demolition and other practices, will definitely backfire. What could be around the corner for the Israeli occupying regime is yet another intifada waiting to happen. After all, Palestinian resistance has entered a new phase and so many young people are taking part in the operations against the Israeli regime. grassroots Palestinians with no affiliation to any of the resistance groups are rising against the regime, like the Den of Lions. The Den of Lions is an independent armed Palestinian group operating in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. The group emerged in August 22 following the killing of a Palestinian man by Israeli forces. Anti-Netanyahu rallies are being held on a weekly basis, with protesters not caring about what is happening to the Israelis in the occupied land, but rather taking aim at a prime minister who is indicted on grave charges and is willing to evade laws to do whatever he can. All in all, point to a situation where things are pulling the Israeli cabinet apart and move the regime to an ultimate annihilation.
In an article published on Responsible Statecraft, it is said that the U.S. role in Ukraine has slowly escalated since the beginning of the war there almost a year ago, saying the question now is how far Washington is willing to go. When the U.S. involves itself in a conflict, it often finds it difficult to get itself out. For instance, it happened in Vietnam. The U.S. military advisors helping the South Vietnamese fight Viet Cong forces eventually became U.S. soldiers fighting an American war. Or in Afghanistan, an initial invasion under the pretext of fighting Al-Qaeda terrorists morphed into 2 decades of war and destruction that resulted in the death of hundreds of thousands of Afghans. The same scenario could be unfolding in Ukraine. Less than a month into the Ukraine war, the US President Joe Biden stated that the US and NATO allies would not fight Russia in Ukraine. However, little by little, Washington and NATO are creeping closer to the catastrophic scenario Biden had described as World War III. Biden had also claimed the U.S. troops will not be sent to Ukraine to take part in the conflict. However, several current and former American intelligence officials told The Intercept back in October that there is a much larger presence of both CIA and U.S. special operations personnel in Ukraine than there was when the war began, saying they are conducting clandestine American operations in the country that are now far more extensive. An 8-year Army Special Operations veteran, who is now an investigative journalist, reported in December that among those covert operations is the CIA's work with an unnamed NATO allies spy agency to carry out sabotage operations within Russia. Reportedly, the cause of the unexplained explosions that have rocked Russian infrastructure throughout the war. Meanwhile, the United States and its NATO allies have serially blown past their own self-imposed lines over arms transfers. At the start of the war, analysts cautioned that the overt supply of even small arms and light weaponry risks encouraging a wider war and possible retaliation from Moscow, while U.S. officials ruled out more advanced weaponry as too escalatory. It took less than 2 months for the Biden administration to start sending these more risky tranches of high-powered arms. By the end of May, it was sending advanced rocket systems. In addition, NATO arms transfers have now escalated well beyond what governments had worried just months ago could draw the alliance into direct war with Russia, with the US and European governments now sending armored vehicles and planning to send tanks. Russia has warned the United States against its planned delivery of Abrams tanks to Ukraine. Anatoly Antonov, Russia's ambassador to the United States, has described the move as a blatant provocation against Moscow. He accused Washington of purposefully trying to inflict a strategic defeat on Russia. The warning came before the U.S. announced the delivery of dozens of its main battle tanks to Ukraine. Two American officials have been quoted as saying that the timeline of any potential delivery remains unclear and could take months or even years. Washington has said previously that providing Abrams tanks to Ukraine is not feasible, citing difficulties in training and maintenance. Meanwhile, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has decided to send Leopard 2 tanks to Ukraine and to allow other countries, such as Poland, to send the same tanks from their own stockpiles to Kyiv. Until now, Berlin had been hesitant to send the Leopards or to allow other nations that have them in their possession to transfer them to Kyiv, with reports early last week saying that Germany would agree to do so only if the US provided its own tanks. The decision by the US to send its Abrams seems to have provided the political cover that Berlin had been seeking. Ukrainian officials have said the tanks would be a game-changer on the battlefield. The country's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, has called for a large number of tanks to repel Russian attacks.
Today, by the way, there's a lot of talk about tanks, about modern tanks that we need, and about the way this shortfall can be filled. A lot of efforts, words, promises. But it is important not to lose sight of reality. It is not about 5 or 10 or 15 tanks. The need is larger.
Zelensky said that Ukraine's allies have the required number of tanks to strengthen the country's defense against Russia. Since the beginning of the war, Ukraine's allies have sent Kyiv tens of billions of dollars worth of weapons. Western countries have also imposed a slew of economic sanctions on Moscow. Now, by escalating their support for Ukraine's military, the US and NATO have created an incentive structure for Moscow to take a drastic, aggressive step to show the seriousness of its own red lines.
The confrontation between Russia and the West is getting more complicated after Germany and the United States announced their decisions to send advanced tanks to Kyiv. The U.S. is sending 31 Abrams battle tanks to Ukraine. Biden told reporters at the White House that the tanks highlight America's enduring commitment to Ukraine.
Today, I'm announcing that the United States will be sending 31 Abrams tanks to Ukraine, the equivalent of one Ukrainian battalion. Secretary Austin has recommended this step because it will enhance the Ukraine's capacity to defend its territory and achieve its strategic objectives. The Abrams tanks are the most capable tanks in the world. They're also extremely complex to operate and maintain. So we're also giving Ukraine the parts and equipment necessary to effectively sustain these tanks on the battlefield.
The reversal of the U.S.'s previous position came after Germany said it will send 14 of its Leopard 2 tanks to Ukraine. Berlin has also given permission to partner countries to re-export other battle tanks to Kyiv. Biden has praised the decision by Germany and stressed on what he called Western unity against Russia. Germany was reluctant to send tanks to Ukraine and was waiting for the U.S. to take the front lead. Britain had earlier announced that it would give Ukraine its Challenger tanks. While Berlin was concerned about escalating the war, Washington cited logistical and maintenance challenges. Western nations had so far refused to give heavy armored vehicles to Ukraine. Kyiv is now pushing its Western allies to deliver fourth-generation fighter jets, such as the American F-16. But the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz says there is no chance of any fighter jets being sent to Ukraine, despite renewed calls for high-end aircraft. Ukraine's Air Force has a fleet of aging Soviet-era fighter jets. Western military support has been vital for Kyiv.
I follow the debate closely surrounding these tanks. You know, you do have a number of German officials and experts, commentators saying we can't have German tanks, you know, on the border with Russia again. This evokes terrible memories of World War II. But the counter argument to this is, because you hear a lot about Russia, is if you look at how Nazi Germany invaded the Soviet Union, it invaded it through Ukraine and Belarus. So Germany also has a historic responsibility.
By announcing his decision to send Leopard tanks to Ukraine, Germany is now actively involved in the war with Russia. The German foreign minister has said that Germany and its allies are, quote, fighting a war against Russia. Comments have been described as rare and frank remarks about the Western role in the conflict. Sergei Nechayev, Russia's ambassador to Germany, said this extremely dangerous decision takes the conflict to a new level of confrontation and contradicts the statements of German politicians about Germany's unwillingness to get involved in it. Russia has harshly criticized the decision by NATO members to send heavy weaponry to Ukraine as a blatant provocation. The Kremlin has said that any Abrams battle tank supplied to Ukraine by the U.S. would, quote, burn. Russian officials have dismissed the expected delivery as an expensive folly. The U.S. Defense Department announced in early January 2023 that it would give an additional $3.1 billion in military aid to Ukraine. In total, the U.S. approved about $50 billion in aid for Ukraine in 2022. About half of that money, or $24.9 billion, went towards military spending. The U.S. also gave $9.6 billion to Ukraine for what it has described as non-military purposes in 2022. It is believed that the small number of Western-supplied tanks manned by poorly trained crews and lacking maintenance and supply infrastructure support is likely to yield negative results. Furthermore, the first deployment of U.S. main battle tanks in Ukraine must come by a significant Ukrainian army success. That would require no fewer than 200 to 300 tanks. The question is whether Western countries are prepared to go for a full-blown confrontation with Russia.
The two biggest economies in South America are starting talks to create a common currency. Brazil's president, Luiz Inácio da Silva, and Argentina's president, Alberto Fernandez, wrote in a joint piece published in Argentinian paper Perfil that they wanted to foster greater integration between the two neighbors. The pair said they had decided to move forward with discussions about a common South American currency that could be used for financial and commercial flows, reducing operating costs and other external vulnerability.
What we're trying to work on right now is to have our finance ministers, each with their economy teams and with a lot of debate and meetings, flow the foreign trade and transaction between the two countries with a common currency.
The announcement came as Lula has visited Argentina for his first trip abroad since taking office at the start of the month. At a press conference in Buenos Aires, he said establishing a common currency for trade would reduce reliance on the U.S. dollar, whose sharp ascent last year was painful for countries around the world. Lula said, "If it depended on me, we would have external commerce always in the same currency of the other countries so we wouldn't have to depend on the dollar." The Financial Times had previously reported, citing Argentina's economy minister Sergio Massa, that the neighboring nations would announce this week they were starting work on a common currency. Massa indicated that though initially a bilateral project, the initiative would be offered to other nations in Latin America, adding it's Argentina and Brazil inviting the rest of the region. Argentina and Brazil are both part of the Mercosur trade bloc, which also includes Paraguay and Uruguay. Talk of creating a common currency has periodically cropped up since its founding in 1991. Brazil is Argentina's largest trade partner. It's the top destination for Argentine exports, amounting to 14.3% and $12.7 billion in 2022. Close to 20% of Argentina's imports are from Brazil, worth just over $16 billion last year. Emerging markets have also been hit hard by the strong U.S. dollar, drawing complaints about its dominance in the global financial system. The greenback rallied nearly 8% against a basket of major currencies in 2022, making imports of food and energy more expensive. Over 24 countries have been the target of unilateral or partial trade sanctions for not adhering to the policies of the U.S. and other Western powers. These limitations, nevertheless, have turned out to be detrimental to the economies of the group of seven nations and have begun to impact the U.S. dollar's hegemony in the world. The International Monetary Fund recorded a decline in central bank holdings of U.S. dollar reserves during the fourth quarter of 2020, which went from 71% to 59%, reflecting the U.S. dollar's waning influence on the world economy. And it continues to worsen. Evidence of this can be seen in the fact that the banking holdings of dollar claims have decreased from $7 trillion in 2021 to $6.4 trillion at the end of March 2022. According to an IMF report, the percentage of U.S. dollars in central bank reserves has decreased by 12% since 1999. While the percentage of other currencies, particularly the Chinese yuan, have shown an increasing trend with a 9% rise during this period. For instance, to boost global commerce and Indian exports, the Reserve Bank of India devised in July last year a rupee settlement mechanism to fend off pressure on the Indian currency. India has recently concluded agreements for currency exchanges of $75.4 billion with the UAE, Japan, and various South Asian nations. New Delhi has also informed South Korea and Turkey of its non-dollar mediated exchange rates for each country's currency. Currently, Turkey conducts business utilizing the national currency of China, yuan, and Russia, ruble. Iran has also proposed to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization euro-like SCO currency for trade among the Eurasian bloc to stop the weaponization of the US dollar-dominated global financial system. Moscow and Beijing have already set up a cross-border interbank payment network similar to SWIFT, increased their gold purchases to give their currencies more stability, and signed agreements to swap national currencies in several regional and bilateral deals. The trend towards de-dollarization in international trade, particularly among the BRICS nations, has gained significant momentum in recent years. Together, they represent 41% of the world's population, 24% of its GDP, and 16% of its commerce. In 2015, the BRICS New Development Bank recommended the use of national currencies in trade. 4 years later, the bank provided 25% of its $15 billion in financial assistance in local currencies and plans to increase this to 50% in the coming years.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
The reports that Poland allegedly gave Ukraine several MiG-29 fighter jets under the guise of spare parts. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov has responded to these planned deliveries as evidence that the West is becoming more directly involved in the conflict, despite European and American politicians claiming otherwise. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT wrote in this regard, in spring 2022, Warsaw secretly delivered several of its MiG-29 fighter jets to Ukraine, despite the Polish government officially denying any such deals, a local paper has claimed, citing sources. According to Dezinik Gazeta Prana, DGP, the planes were sent over using a combined method, apparently meaning that they were delivered in a disassembled state and declared as spare parts. DGP wrote recently, citing sources within the Polish government, the fuselage and the wings are also spare parts. Back in March, in the first month of the Russia special operation in Ukraine, Washington rejected a plan of transfer of Polish MiG-29 jets to Ukraine, stating the move was too escalatory and risked directly involving the US or a NATO ally in the conflict, potentially triggering a direct confrontation with Russia. In April, however, the Pentagon stated that unnamed U.S. allies had helped bolster Ukraine's fleet of fighter jets by donating unspecified spare parts which were supposedly used to restore many of Kiev's damaged planes. The latest article by DGP now seems to suggest that that ally could have been Poland, which in late April was also revealed to have provided Ukraine with $7 billion worth of military aid, including half of its tanks, dozens of howitzers, Grad MRLS, and missiles for MiG-29 and Su-27 fighter jets, among other munitions. In recent weeks, the U.S. seems to have abandoned some of its prior concerns about supplying heavy weapons to Ukraine and now plans to deliver a number of its M1 Abrams tanks to Kiev, while Germany, Poland, and Finland intend to send dozens of their Leopard 2 tanks. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov has responded to these planned deliveries as evidence that the West is becoming more directly involved in the conflict, despite European and American politicians claiming otherwise. That's as Russia has repeatedly urged the West to stop pumping Ukraine with weaponry, arguing it would only prolong the conflict and lead to more bloodshed. Meanwhile, RT reported the U.S. arms maker claims it could supply fighter jets to countries that are willing to give them to Kiev. Any countries that are prepared to provide Kiev with F-16 fighter jets would face no shortage of supply. Top U.S. weapons manufacturer Lockheed Martin has suggested, stating that it is ready to meet any new demand. In an interview with the Financial Times recently, the weapons manufacturer's chief operating officer, Frank St. John, said there is a lot of conversation about third-party transfer of F-16s, meaning countries that wish to buy and then re-export their U.S. jets to Ukraine. Although Lockheed Martin is not directly involved in any talks regarding potential deliveries of military aircraft to Kiev, St. John stated his company nevertheless plans to ramp up production of the fighter planes to get to the point where it will be able to backfill pretty capable any countries that choose to do third-party transfers to help with the current conflict. His statements come after the U.S. and Germany announced this week that they would be sending their heavy tanks to Ukraine. The move has reignited discussion about other weapon transfers, as Kiev reiterated its demands for more missiles and military aircraft. Washington, however, has so far remained reluctant to provide any fighter jets to Ukraine, fearing these could be used to strike Russian territory, further escalating the 11-month-long conflict between the two countries in Eastern Europe. Furthermore, any sales or transfers to third countries of any American-made fighter jets must also be approved by the White House. A U.S. defense official has told the Financial Times that Washington remains in contact with its international allies and partners regarding the needs of Ukraine, but noted that there is nothing to announce regarding F-16s. The Netherlands, on the other hand, which has about 40 F-16 fighter jets, has recently said that it would consider any formal request to send the planes to Ukraine with an open mind and that it holds no taboos in relation to military support. Russia has repeatedly warned the West that continued deliveries of weapons to Ukraine only prolonged a conflict and risked a direct confrontation between NATO and Moscow. It also said its forces would treat foreign weapon systems in Ukraine as legitimate targets.